Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have as my guest Stanton T. Friedman, who is the author of Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They, in parentheses, Declared Impossible. And truly it is so. All throughout recorded human history anyway, people have said things are impossible, things will never work, everything that is to be discovered in physics has already been discovered, a while ago anyway. And all of these things, of course, are probably the result of human hubris and emotions that we probably need to weed out of the human race, thinking that we know it all. Stanton is a nuclear physicist who was employed by industrial companies. He worked in highly advanced classified nuclear programs, and then became interested in the UFO and alien abduction information. He is the author of Flying Saucers in Science and the co-author of Captured, which is a detailed account of one of the most credible alien abduction accounts that that has been recorded. And Stanton has educated probably millions of people on the science behind these phenomena, and has brought, I guess, the truth to many, and also the way to look at things. You can't be a believer where you believe everything, and you can't be a skeptic where you believe nothing. You have to be objective, and that's what Stanton Friedman's book is all about, objectivity. Thanks for joining us, Stanton. Where are you calling in from?
I am calling in from beautiful downtown Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, 73 miles east of Holton, Maine, which is at the quiet end of I-95. So I live in Canada.
Wonderful.
We don't see much traffic between Holton and Bangor.
Right.
I'm a dual citizen of the United States and Canada. I can complain legally about both governments, and they do deserve some complaints. And I should add, incidentally, my co-author on Science Was Wrong is Kathleen Marden.
Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't mention her. I met Kathleen in the bathroom at the Truth Convention. That's why you're on the show.
Well, that's where all important meetings take place.
That's right.
The new coffee shop. Yes,
that's right.
Well, Kathleen did 7 of the 14 chapters, and I did 7. And admittedly, she did 85% of the work on the book Captured, which is about her aunt and uncle Betty and Barney Hill.
I would love to have Kathleen on the show for that. If you can pass that message to her.
Okay. Well, I will, because we've worked together quite a bit. As a matter of fact, for any listeners who are going to be in New Hampshire in the next month or so, we will both be presenting at the Exeter, New Hampshire 3rd Annual UFO Conference on Saturday, September 3rd. We'll each be speaking. And then there is an incredible event, at least unique as far as I'm concerned, on the 23rd and 24th of September. In Lincoln, New Hampshire, at the this is right next to where the Betty and Barney Hill event took place. There will be a 50th anniversary celebration, and the dedication by an official state plaque, if you will. It took Kathy an awful lot of work to satisfy all their needs for making sure everything was correct.
Right.
But it will be dedicated. And I don't know of any other UFO event that has been, if you will, recognized by the state in which it occurred. And so I will be there, too, and there's going to be a bus tour of the whole area and go over the whole case, and we'll be signing books and all that sort of thing. But I'm really looking forward to it. I have been in that area before, and Indian Head Resort is where this will happen. And the Hill case is very important, not just because it's an exciting story, but because of the people who were involved and the fact that there was no model to copy. You know, people say, oh, they're just copying somebody else's experience. Well, there had been no publicity for any alien abduction experience
right.
Before the Hill case. And what's really important, although it was frustrating to me at times, is that the psychiatrist who did the hypnosis sessions with Betty and Barney, separately, of course, Dr. Benjamin Simon, he didn't know a darn thing about flying saucers.
Mm-hmm. But that may have helped him, though.
What?
That may have helped him.
Well, I think so, because he was a world-class expert at what we would today call treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
Back then, it was shell shock war veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out of World War II, he directed a hospital that had 3,000 beds for such people. And his technique of medical hypnosis, inducing amnesia after each session and then gradually inducing things back into their psyche, if you will, was by far the most successful at getting these poor veterans back to the living.
Right.
And his expertise, in other words, was in dealing with people. And the Army actually made a movie, the United States Army made a movie, Let There Be Light, starring Dr. Simon.
Really?
About his work with these veterans. So, you know, that's kind of a gold seal of approval that this is
mm-hmm.
a guy who knows what he's doing. And he is on the record as saying that the emotional intensity when Betty and Barney each were separately reliving their experiences was as great as that of any of the war veterans that he had worked with. And as a matter of fact, he had to stop one session each. There were about 10 each. Because he wasn't sure they could handle it. Pulse rate going way up, you know, terror.
Right, yeah.
Pure terror that you can't fake, not with a guy like that.
Well, if you think about it, in war, even though it can be surprising, it's not really a surprise. You're going into war. You're going to get shot at. You're going to have shells thrown
sure.
at you. You're going to get bombed. But in the UFO abduction, you don't know what's happening, plus you have no point of reference for anything. I would think
that's right.
Emotionally,
that's right.
It would be way more, you know, you might be tortured. You don't know.
And you may never come back, too.
You may never come back.
You know, you worry about
right.
those things. And they, how shall I put this? These were two very respectable people. And Betty was a social worker, a supervisor in a welfare department, state of New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Barney had worked for the post office at the time, but was also on the governor's civil rights committee in New Hampshire. And the two of them and Kathleen were invited to the inauguration of Lyndon Johnson in 1964.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, these are ultra respectable. I should add now, Barney was black, Betty was white, which makes a statement made by one of the debunkers, Dr. Seth Shostak, one of the SETI cultists, as I like to call them. They were Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch America, he said, to Susan Clancy, who did a book supposedly about abductions.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long story. And there's a piece on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com, about Susan's, quote, research, unquote. But for Seth, with whom I have debated and won, incidentally, to say that they were Mr. and Mrs. Front Porch America, Barney Black, Betty White, New Hampshire, 1961, miscegenation laws were all over the place.
Yeah, probably not.
not Mr. and Mrs.
No.
Front Porch by any stretch of the imagination. But, and I should add, incidentally, that, of course, Kathleen knew about the case the day after it happened, not the
right.
abduction part, because they didn't know until the hypnosis, but she was home when her mother, Betty's older sister, was called by Betty.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in the room when the telephone
right.
conversation went on, and she went down with her family a few days later and saw the physical effects on the car
mm-hmm.
and the torn dress and other stuff. So Kathy worked on it very close to Betty and was very close to her the last several years of her life and is the trustee of her estate. And this is the first time now that we're getting out something. Kathleen has put together an incredible DVD in their own words, 132 minutes, and it includes many, many excerpts from the actual medical hypnosis tapes by Dr. Simon.
Right.
And I stress that because there's all kinds of nonsense that's been said about this case. But one of the silliest was that, well, Barney was very upset under hypnosis, but Betty, it was like a walk to the supermarket. Anybody who listens to the tapes will know that that's utter nonsense.
Right. Yeah.
It's a great deal of terror. Not every minute of every tape, of course not. The point of making the stuff available is so that people can make up their own minds.
Yeah,
listening to the actual evidence.
Oh yeah, and it's medical hypnosis, so it's not it can't be faked theoretically.
It's not parlor games. That's right.
Right.
As a matter of fact, both Kathy and I agree that anybody who says, "Oh, they think they've been abducted, let's hypnotize them," that's the wrong approach.
We think you have
to have other evidence. Somebody around who can say they were gone for 2 hours when they shouldn't have been. Somebody who sees them when they come back and are confused. You've got to do an investigation first.
Or like you say in your book, they don't get returned to their bed. They get returned outside their deadbolted house. You know,
yeah, that's a real neat trick.
Think about that. That's a real trick, yeah.
And real scary, too. There have been children that are found outside the house when everything is locked. And if you don't think that's scary for a parent, you're wrong.
Oh, yeah. if you study the abduction cases overall, like over time, and there's too many things that are similar in each case. And one of my friends who was with the military and had a great deal of information about remote viewing and UFOs and all of that, and is an experienced tracker. And he said that pretty much, in his opinion, because he's been involved in the world for a long time, he thinks that anybody who actually sees a spacecraft, like you're driving down a country road and you see this craft hovering over you, he says 9 times out of 10 you've been abducted. I mean, once you see it that close. And that's an interesting idea.
I think that's probably close to true. What is worrisome is that there are people who confuse sleep paralysis. I woke up
Night, I'm saying see the craft, though, right over your car. not off in the distance, like the fighter pilots see them, but right, right there. Because they go into the time-space continuum somehow, and you lose time, but you don't know you've lost time unless you've got some outside reference.
It's seamless. That's right.
Right. And it's some technology that we just, I don't know.
We'd like to have, of course.
Exactly. I think some portion of our secret government may know about it, but we certainly don't understand it yet. Although, I don't know if you had followed some of David Wilcox's theories. He gave a thing on Sunday after the Truth Convention, and he did a pretty good job of explaining how they do it, including some of the patents that are out there on it. So it's very interesting.
Well, there's a lot of exciting stuff going on.
There really is.
As a nuclear physicist, I get upset when people, the nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm so polite, or fossilized physicists when I'm not so polite, people can't seem to understand that the proof of the pudding varies from the situation. You can't always control the variables. Just because you can't doesn't mean it's not science. Carl Sagan and I had a discussion about this at his house. We were classmates at the University of Chicago for 3 years. And I saw him a year before he died at his home in Ithaca, New York. We had coffee and cookies. I was speaking that night, and he couldn't go to the lecture because he had something else going on. But so we got together, and he talked about reproducibility as the essence of science. Well, I sent him a letter afterward going into great detail that there are several, at least 4 kinds of science. First is when you control everything. You set up an experiment. You set up the equipment. You decide how you take readings and all the rest of that. And you do it again, and then you write up a paper, and it goes in for peer review, and it gets published, and you hope other people will be able to duplicate the results. We need that. I mean, that is science, all right. But there are, for example, situations in which you can't control all the variables. Eclipses. If I tell you, this sounds crazy, but sometimes the moon comes between the Earth and the sun, and it dark down here during the day. And you say, hey, 10 o'clock tomorrow, I'll bring a camera, you show me. I don't believe that. Well, I don't have the power to control the positions of the sun, the moon, and the earth. But what I can do is predict when it will happen, and if the weather is good, you know, I can make measurements. A third kind, I can't predict, I can't control, but I can be ready. Earthquakes, for example. I know they're going to happen, but I can't tell you exactly where or when or how strong. I can set up seismometers. When Carl and I were at the University of Chicago, we were wanting to find out what kind of particles were emitted by the sun during a solar storm. We knew that X-rays come out, and they get here awful hurry, the speed of light. But if we could get a block of nuclear emulsion, which records the passage of particles, we could get it ready on a balloon out at Stagg Field. Somebody could rush over when the detectors say, hey, there's a storm, and release the balloon, the balloon, and hopefully recover it later. It's got a piece of identification on it. You know, if you find this, please let us know, et cetera. You can get all kinds of useful data, but you couldn't control, you couldn't predict, you can observe. But then there's the fourth kind of science, where human intelligence, or I'll put it differently, where intelligence is involved, intelligence in quotes, automobile accidents, airplane crashes, bank robberies, rapes. These are events that you can study scientifically, even though you can't control, you can't predict, you can't have observations all over the place. I mean, more than 30,000 people will die in automobile accidents this coming year in the United States. I don't know who, I don't know where, I don't know when, but when an accident happens, I can measure skid marks. I can check alcohol levels on the part of the driver. Brake
you can
lines.
Often see them because of all the cameras up now.
Well, some of them will be under observation. But you see what I mean? You can use the techniques of science. And you got to be careful that you don't demand too great an accuracy. For example, if somebody says, you ask them, how tall was the bank robber? If they say, well, 6 feet plus or minus 20%. That's not good enough because that covers most of the population.
Right.
You know, if you say, I saw the saucer going 1,000 miles an hour, it stopped dead, it was silent, and then it went straight up. The fact that it might have been 800 miles an hour or 1,200 miles an hour, that it might have gone up at 70 degrees or 80 degrees rather than 90 degrees, those are irrelevant because you've described something that's outside.
It can't happen here.
Yeah.
With us, with humans.
That's right. So you have to be flexible. And also, you learn. You have to learn pretty quickly. I did this in radiation shielding, which was my concern. I started off thinking, gee, if I absorb 99% of the radiation coming out of the reactor, I'm doing a heck of a job. As I moved along in the field, I realized I just would have killed everybody that went by because it's 99.999%. It's what gets out that matters, not how much that gets absorbed. So you got to watch, and also you got to learn to deal with what's special. Most sightings can be explained. So what? Most isotopes aren't fissionable. Ask a basketball coach. Most people are not 7 feet tall. He says, give me one. What do I care about the midgets of the world? Give me one. So you focus on what's relevant. Yes, most UFO sightings can be explained. So what? As an example, the biggest study ever done in the United States. What?
There's a lot of stuff up in the sky, and we don't always know what it is.
What I found is that people are good observers, but poor interpreters. In the largest study ever done for the United States Air Force, Project Blue Book Special Report Number 14. This covered 3,201 cases. The work was done by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, under Air Force contract. This wasn't a bunch of UFO nuts. And they found 21.5% of the 3,201 cases could not be explained, completely separate from the 9.3% listed as insufficient information. And I always get people claiming, well, the only reason those sightings couldn't be explained is that there wasn't enough data. By definition, that was not the case. 9.3% insufficient information, 21.5% unexplainable. Now, I should add, I mean, I know this is going to shock you, but sometimes the government lies.
You think?
We've got to allow for that. The press release that went out when that study was done, the Secretary of the Air Force, surely there's no higher authority than that, said, I am sure, on the basis of this report, I believe that, no objects such as those properly described as flying saucers have overflown the United States. Even the unknown 3% could have been identified as conventional phenomena or illusions if more complete observational data had been available. Very straightforward, 3% unknown just because there wasn't enough data.
Right.
When you look at the report, it was
21%.
21.5%.
And a lot of these are
not enough data.
A lot of these observers are very, very highly trained military people.
Yeah.
They observe pretty well.
I refer people to Dr. James E. McDonald's congressional testimony, mind you. 12 of us provided testimony hearings July 29th, 1968, my birthday. That's not why they held the hearings that day. I share that birthday with Peter Jennings and Benito Mussolini. What a couple. Anyway, in Jim's testimony, he provided information on 41 separate excellent sightings, multiple witness radar visual cases, sightings by pilots, sightings by astronomers, sightings by meteorologists, sightings over big cities, multiple witness cases.
And
I still get people saying, you know, there's no good cases out there, just some nut out in the boondocks making up the story.
This is not true. If you look at the data, like you say in your book, there is a lot of data from, you know, radar and other instruments that are describing things that sonar, because of the underground things, you know, I mean, underwater sightings, you know. There's a lot of data. I think that anybody who would like to learn more about this, I just interviewed the author of Flying Saucers Over the White House, which is actually the story of the Blue Book Project, and that will be playing in October, and they can listen to that later on this year.
Oh, who did you interview?
Let's see. He's in England, but it's Flying Saucers Over the White House.
I
have his name here.
That wasn't Nick Pope.
No, I don't have the.
Well, I'll look it up. Okay.
Yeah,
I'm looking forward to that.
It's going to play in October, and let's see. Trying to think where. Oh, there it is. Colin Bennett. Flying Saucers Over the White House. You know Colin?
Yes. Yeah.
Yes.
One
he requested to be interviewed early because of poor health, unfortunately.
Oh, I didn't know he was in poor health.
Yeah, you might want to give him a call. Yeah.
I'm probably older than he is, but I'm in good health, so, you know.
Well, I'm ex Air Force. I spent 13 years in the Air Force, and I used to sit alert with the Louisiana National Guard in Louisiana. So I know the fighter pilots saw stuff a lot. I know I was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for 4 years, and people kept telling me they saw live aliens. And, you know, they had no reason to lie to me. I was a plastic surgeon there. And now I understand why they were seeing aliens dead and alive, because on UFO files, there was a whole segment on what was going on at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, much of when I was there in the 80s.
Well, you know, I signed books at a Barnes & Noble. All my books are listed at my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. But I signed books at a Barnes & Noble in Dayton, just outside Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And seven different people quietly told me they worked out at the base, and they had heard stories about bodies being out there. And as a matter of fact, one of the more interesting people that I didn't see then, but I've met since, was the guy who was in charge of the crash test dummy drop program in the 50s. And his picture, as a matter of fact, with one of the dummies, and the dummy is taller than he is, incidentally, it's in the book by the Air Force. They're case closed. One of those strange explanations for UFOs, the Roswell report, case closed. Anyway, he made clear to me that, A, none of the dummies were dropped before 1953, which means you've got time travel to explain Roswell dummies, you know, from 47 to 53. Everyone knows how to time travel crash test dummies.
Don't bother me with the facts.
Yes. And he stressed to me that the dummies were 6 feet tall and weighed 175 pounds. And if you look at the
human
picture, these were standard pilots,
dummies,
in other words.
Right.
If you're going to test an ejection seat and stuff like that,
it's not going to look like an alien.
Use the right simulation, if you will. And incidentally, they were also in uniform because that affects the drag, the heating of the body, you know, how it comes down and all that stuff, how soon you freeze before you get to freeze in that cold.
Right.
But he told me two things that were of interest. I met with him in person. When he was based at Wright-Patterson, he was working on a special project concerned with the U-2. His boss didn't know what he was doing, and he got a bad rating. He had to get the guy he was working with, Mark Boss. He made work right as well. Both of them had heard about stories of there being alien bodies at Wright-Patterson. Now, what do you say about a guy like that? He's going to lie to me? What for?
Well, you know, the thing is, these people, first of all, were military officers that had jobs, and I think that they were, and they were involved in things like secret projects, and I think that they talked to people who they could talk to because people have a need to, you know, tell things if they feel that there is a, you know, if there's safety in doing so. It was safe
security,
for them to talk to me. I wasn't going to tell anybody. Safe for them to talk to you. They can't talk to their coworkers in the military, obviously.
You've hit on a crucial point, though. Many people don't understand how national security works.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not just for flying saucers. This is for all kinds of stuff. Mind control work, for example. Medical things that we may know about and don't want to tell anybody about. But security, I get people who think that a couple of strange things. One, everything is automatically declassified after, pick a number, 25 years. That isn't true. Some few things are, but plenty of it will stay classified forever. Secondly, they think that if you got, say, a secret clearance, you have access to everything that's rated secret. Nonsense.
Nope.
You need to know.
And I had a secret clearance. I certainly wasn't. I didn't know everything.
Well, I, for example, when I was working on nuclear airplanes for General Electric, I was involved heavily in radiation shielding experiments, and I read classified abstracts.
Mm-hmm.
And in there were listed reports done by the nuclear Navy on radiation shielding experiments, and they were secret restricted data reports, and I had clearance for secret restricted data, but I couldn't get them to give me a need to know. The Navy said, everybody else stay away from our work.
Right, yeah.
That's the way the system works.
Need
and,
to know. You're absolutely
you
right.
You know, that's the real world. Sorry, folks. And also, we get, you'll appreciate this, I think, we get people saying, oh, governments can't keep secrets. Seth Shostak again has said that, look at FEMA and Katrina, what a lousy job. And look at the government operates the post office. Who cares? We're interested in NSA, NRO, CIA, DIA, ONI, OSI, you know, the alphabet soup of intelligence agencies. And the ultimate insult to the intelligence of the American people, Dr. Tyson, who's the head of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, very personable kind of guy. I've watched him on television. At a talk at Penn State University a few months ago, said, you know, isn't it ridiculous people think governments can keep secrets? That we can't is clearly shown by how much we know about the genitalia of President Clinton.
Right.
Now, that's really connected with national security matters, you know. An incredible statement. And I also, in Flying Saucers and Science, talk about a number of expensive, large-scale scientific studies.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to think that the only people who do research are those in academia.
No,
and that's
not true.
The publisher parish crowd is there, but the big programs, Manhattan Project and Stealth and all the rest, are done outside of academia and spend tons of money. Stealth was done $10 billion over 10 years.
And you're going to not know the scope of those programs until much later because they don't publish unless...
That's right.
They,
that's
you know, right. unless they are directed to for a particular purpose. I mean, it's not...
So, you were in a good position to see that the real world operates somewhat differently.
Oh, yeah, it does. And also, like, when I was watching the UFO files on Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, they explained that the reason why, and you explain this in your book, too, the reason why the Roswell crash happened was because a ship, probably coming off a mothership, you know, just a ship for our atmosphere, was hit with, what was it, the... radar.
There were lightning storms, there were radar beams,
because later on, what it said in the UFO files is that they tried to reproduce this and, you know, shoot the same type of thing, and of course, those craft fell out of the sky, too. And evidently, this went on for a while, and what they said in the UFO files is that all of the craft and bodies were always being brought to Wright-Patt. So Wright-Patt was, you know, the depository, not just at Roswell, but everything.
No.
And so it was ongoing.
I had
and if you don't think our government might not try to shoot them down, I you don't know our government very well.
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a book called Shoot Them Down,
right?
by Frank Fascino. I wrote the foreword for the book.
Uh-huh.
And it's focused mainly on 1952. The Flatwoods Monster event in West Virginia, but more important, 52 was the biggest year in Blue Book history.
Yeah.
That's when there were all those sightings over Washington that you mentioned during the show in October.
And there's reasons for that. You know, we were developing nuclear weapons and testing them above ground. And you know, you say in your book,
Wright-Patterson, as you know, but many of our listeners might not know, is a huge base.
Yeah.
Population varied from 20 to 30,000. There are 1,000 buildings on campus, so to speak. I had a call from a young man who was all form that there is a cover-up and they're going to do something about it. He and his friends are going to go to the gate and break in and find those bodies.
Well, it's a guarded gate, so good luck.
Well, I told him, I said, you ever been there? No. I said, well, I have. I had a security clearance for the work I was doing there.
Right.
I needed an escort to go where I wanted to go. Mm-hmm. There were plenty of places that I couldn't go.
Right.
Security is a big thing there. And if you think you're going to break in and wander around and say, hey, bodies, let me know where you are. We'll take care of you. You're wrong.
No.
You know? Incidentally, Wright-Patterson is the place where we offered a little bonus to a foreign pilot if he would bring in a MiG, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We'd like to have one for examination. And we got a couple, and that's the place you bring them.
Yeah.
Standard practice, in other words, for any foreign, in quotes, technology.
And that's why they brought the craft there, because they were already doing that in general, you know, anything.
Yeah, back engineering. And,
right,
you
they were back engineering, because there's huge numbers of engineers on that base, I'll tell you that.
Well, the foreign technology group that I worked with had loads of good engineers and scientists, and I was very favorably impressed with them.
Yeah.
And my job, incidentally, I'll give you the title of my contract, but I will leave one word out. It was analysis and evaluation of fast and intermediate reactors for space vehicle applications.
Mm.
That sounds innocent enough, but the word that's left out is Soviet.
to look at
Soviet technology to try to figure out how far along they were. And I probably was the only person in the United States who was happy to hear about the crash of Cosmos 954 up in Canada, because it had a nuclear reactor on board.
Right.
It was the 13th that the Russians had launched. The United States had launched one, and they wound up launching 35, and somebody might say, who cares? Well, if you got a nuclear reactor on board a space satellite, you got more electrical power available to you than with a solar-paneled system. And so they could put out particle beam weapons and sideband radar. None of the press coverage mentioned these little details. That's what was important, not whether the caribou near Great Slave Lake were getting too much radiation.
Well, the Russians have consistently outperformed what we thought they could do. So that's
well, part of that is, I think, the Eastern establishment attitude. They're just a bunch of dumb peasants over there.
I don't think so.
As a matter of fact, General Wesley Groves, who ran the Manhattan Engineering District that developed nuclear weapons, in late 1948, in early 1948, I guess, he said the Russians wouldn't have an atomic bomb for at least 7 or 8 years because they just didn't have the industrial capacity that the United States did. It happened the next year, 1949.
Well, I think they can get things done as quickly as we can because of their form of government.
They also had slave labor.
They can throw a vast amount of resources without any discussion about it. You know,
they had the biggest cyclotron in Europe before World War II. And you see, my ancestry is Russian, and so I resent the notion that this is a bunch of dumb peasants who didn't go to Harvard and Yale, you know.
They have their own universities, you know, in Russia.
Oh, really? Do they have universities, too? Well,
it's the same thing. The theme throughout your book is that people who think they know it all are saying that nobody else can know what they know, and therefore nothing else can be known, and it won't work.
Yeah, I mean, love the quotes from the top astronomer in the United States in the 19th century. In October 1903, he gave a long statement to the effect that he was absolutely certain men would never be able to fly any distance in a vehicle. That was 2 months before the Wright brothers' first flight. The British astronomer Royal, less than 2 years before Sputnik went up, said, space travel is utter bilge. Nobody will spend the money to do it, and what good would it do anyway? What we need to do is to buy better instruments for astronomers. And you know what? Astronomy has benefited more from the space program than any other science, because we're finally getting a true picture of what's going on out there, as opposed to the democratically derived truths that we had before that.
Right. Well, there's a Chinese saying that says, those who say it cannot be done should not get in the way of those doing it.
I like it. Well, it's true. And
it's true.
It scares me in a way because I worked on a space program. And everybody I know who also worked on a space program thought that by this time we would have a base on the moon, we would have gone to Mars. Now we don't even have a way to get an American up to the space station.
Nope, got
to
use the Russians. That's right.
Yeah, and the Chinese, India, Japan are all moving in the direction of getting men into space.
Right.
And we're going to be left behind, and I hate to see that. And the real reason, I think, is a lack of leadership.
A lack of what?
The nuclear navy had Admiral Rickover. He said, we're going to build a nuclear submarine. I don't care what all those battleship guys say. We're going to build it. It's going to work. We have to buy two of everything to make one work. We're going to do it.
Yeah.
Nautilus set sail in 1956.
Right.
We have a whole fleet of nuclear submarines. And something that most of your listeners probably don't know, we have nuclear-powered aircraft carriers. And you say, so what? Well, that means you can steam full power for years and years. As a matter of fact, they can operate for 18 years without refueling.
That's amazing.
Think about that for a minute. It impresses the heck out of me.
Yeah, no kidding. No, I didn't know we had nuclear-powered aircraft carriers.
Well, the nuclear-powered aircraft carrier illustrates something that's related to my views on flying saucers. You got this monster ship, and they're big, about a quarter mile long, you know. And the nuclear ones can go for years and years and years and years without refueling. They carry about 75 little airplanes that can only go for, 2 hours without refueling?
They have to refuel, right.
Yeah, so we have spaceships coming from other solar systems, motherships, if you will, that operate probably by nuclear fusion. And fusion, we sometimes forget that we know about fusion. You know, it's the most important source of energy in all our lives. The sun up there is a fusion factory. That's the process. all the stars out there, the billions and billions of them,
fusion.
Operate by nuclear fusion.
Right.
And we have produced fusion devices.
Right.
Our first fusion weapon in 1952, Mike it was called. Don't ask me why, because I don't know. It released the energy of 10 million tons of TNT. One bomb, the fireball, was 3 miles wide.
Mm-hmm.
A big bomb in 1942, 10 years earlier, was a 10-ton bomb.
Mm-hmm.
This was 10 million tons.
Yeah.
And the Russians outdid us with one that was 57 million tons.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you want a mess, you're going to get one that way. But the important point is, fusion can also be used for a propulsion system if you want to spend the money. It takes lots and lots and lots of money. And people, I got a note from a guy, an email saying, where could he get $10 million? He knows how these saucers work, and if he only had $10 million, he'd be able to prove it. When I was working on nuclear airplanes way back in 1958 for GE, we spent $100 million that year, and that was a lot of money back then.
Yeah, well,
we employed 3,500 people full-time, 1,100 of them engineers and scientists. We did not fly a nuclear-powered aircraft. So 10 million bucks is peanuts.
Nothing. Right.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of effort. I'm not saying we should even build a fusion propulsion system. Lord knows, we've got enough problems on this planet. And let me touch on that relates directly to another thing that people don't seem to understand. I just got another email. You know, why don't they just land and, you know, take me to your leader routine, land on a White House lawn? Why would they not do that? It's a no-fly zone at the in Washington, for one thing.
For one thing.
But don't people understand that this is a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare?
Mm-hmm.
In World War II, we killed, we Earthlings, Terrans for the science fiction fans out there, we Terrans killed 50 million of our own kind.
Right.
We destroyed 1,700 cities. Now, if you were an alien looking at these idiots, you'd say they're a primitive society, their major activity is tribal warfare. If they come out, they're going to take their brand of friendship with them.
Mm-hmm.
And since they already are keyed into fusion, they could be out within 100 years, which is nothing.
They could be very dangerous
time
to us. Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, who would want us out there? I've asked a lot of people, if you were an alien, would you want Earthlings out there?
Well, and how could the aliens
no.
figure out where to land? I mean, do you go to Russia? Do you go to America? There's no world White House lawn to land on.
And there's nobody who speaks for the planet. I hate
right,
to disabuse
exactly.
some people.
So that's a problem, because if you're going to negotiate...
With whom?
With whom, that's right.
The president... I hate to say this to people, but the President of the United States doesn't speak for 310 million Americans, and he certainly doesn't speak for just about 7
the
billion
world, yeah.
Earthlings. At least last I heard, he doesn't. And you get a measure of our society by the simple fact that we collectively will spend $1 trillion this year on things military. The U.S. about $600 billion and the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Every single day, at least 25,000 children die of preventable disease or starvation.
Right, that's true.
Now, putting those two facts alongside each other, doesn't that tell you a lot about us?
It does. It does.
I
we're not that advanced yet into the galactic community that we are.
That's right.
We wouldn't be able to join that community. That's true.
You know,
I mean, well,
people don't realize how much things have changed. I got my comeuppance.
Mm-hmm.
Was speaking to a group of students at the University of Detroit,
mm-hmm.
and I was going over how much in the last 50 years it changed. Technology, you know, no internet and DNA
mm-hmm.
being found,
right.
all the rest of this stuff. And I finished by saying, you know, when I started work in industry, I was using a slide rule.
Mm-hmm.
Looked around the audience, didn't see any reaction at all.
Any
of you know what a slide rule is, I said? Not one student did. Boy, did that make me feel old.
I remember a slide rule. I had to beg my parents for $125 for a calculator because I couldn't use the slide rule. I couldn't figure out the decimal points well enough to do chemistry. And without the slide rule and using the calculator, I did fine. But no, I mean, it was a big advance to get that calculator. It really was.
And now it costs, what, $5?
Oh, less than that. You can get them for 99 cents.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about two things that were in a book called Alien Mind. Have you ever read that book?
I don't think I have, but I've heard the title, and I don't know.
Alien Mind is a wonderful book. It's a book by an investigative journalist who claims to have spent 10,000 hours with aliens at different levels that work with our government. There's three different levels, and he differentiates them. But in any case, the aliens are saying that there are two major tests for a civilization to go through that they need to pass before they come into the galactic community. And one is being able to control their reproduction. And most of them do that by becoming asexual. You know, in other words, they graduate to an asexual society where children are cloned and raised in very protected special environments, and not just anybody can have kids, which makes sense to me. I mean, makes sense that that would be something that you would have to conquer before you would be able to become truly civilized. And then the second one is how they use, once they discover it, and I think parts of our world has discovered it, but it's top secret, and that's the energy that is Tom Bearden and others have. In fact, Tom Bearden's stuff is in the book because Tom Bearden...
Energy of the Vacuum.
Right. It was funny because I called Tom Bearden up and I said, have you ever read Alien Mind? He said, no. I said, well, you might want to. They talk about you in the book all the time, you know, for the first chapter explaining explaining the science. But in any case, the idea of free energy, which of course is probably not free, but the aliens say that the free energy is not free because what happens is when you use it excessively on, say, a worldwide scale, you burn out your sun very fast. And civilizations have actually done that. So these are the two major tests that we're not even thinking about how to control population.
The Chinese are.
Well, the Chinese are. You're absolutely right. But on a worldwide scale, not been addressed in any significant way.
No.
And
very
free
important.
Free energy, or the they've got some other names for it. But anyway, this energy is not known, and anybody who tries to talk about it is suppressed. But for you, I think you'd find it fascinating. It's more of a psychological study as well. I mean, he's got good insight into what motives and what the...
Alien Mind singular?
It's called Alien Mind, yeah. I forget the author. I haven't interviewed him. I'm hoping to interview him later. But he's an investigative journalist and writes the book at a level that I think you'd appreciate.
Sounds very interesting.
It's very interesting.
The kicker here is many members of the scientific community don't seem to understand that you can have great ideas, but you can't put them into practice until you spend a lot of money.
Right.
So don't compare something that's highly developed with something that's just beginning and say, oh, that's no good, or that can't work. Or most ideas turn out to be worthless. So what? Again, most isotopes aren't fissionable.
Right.
I'm a nuclear guy. Give me the one that is.
Right.
So new ideas need more attention rather than the disdain. I mean, that's one of the whole points, of course, of science was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And the kicker is, I don't need to tell you as a doctor, that the kicker is that there are consequences when the all-knowing top people make decisions that can be fatal for the people who, you know...
For lots and lots and lots of people. In fact, you give numbers in your medicine section. You talk about politics, personalities, and childhood fever, which is one of the greatest travesties of... not paying attention to somebody who figured out what was going on. You need to wash your hands before you go from the autopsy room to the ward
delivery
where the
room.
Pregnant women are and examine them. The smallpox wars. The hemophilia holocaust. That's when all the hemophiliacs got AIDS because the blood transfusions weren't supposed to carry it when they did.
Yeah, one chance in a million, said the key doctor.
Right.
Boy, was he wrong.
Yeah. And methylmercury in the food chain. That's a very, very good chapter about the concentration of methylmercury in the larger fish and why that can be deadly. And that's just the medicine section. You've got all sorts of other sections in here. Global warming,
There's a scam for you.
Yeah, my brother is an atmospheric scientist who presents at Congress on global warming, and I called him up the other day, and I said, "Hey, Charles," I said, I don't know about warming. I called him up when the whole country was under snow at Christmas, and I said, "You know, I think we might be in for global cooling," and it was so funny. He said, "What might happen in the next 1,000 years?" I said, "Okay." I don't discuss politics with him, but I did. I had to ask him that little question.
Well,
but you know, I don't think
in England right now they are dismantling some of the systems they set up for alternative energy, subsidized at great cost by the government, by the people. And it turns out very expensive. And well, we here in New Brunswick, our windmills stopped when it got cold. Very helpful, you know.
Right.
But, yeah, we need courses at the college level, really, to get people, we have so many examples, to look at the real world and to be wary of the pronouncements from on high about impossibility.
Right.
And I'm not saying every new idea is a good one. Of course it isn't. But, you know, in baseball, a guy gets paid a lot of money for getting a hit one-third of the time.
Right.
Not 98%, not 90%, one-third of the time. If only 1 in 10 of the new ideas are good ones, you get a lot of progress. If you smash them by not making support available, by ridiculing, you've lost the good ones as well as the bad ones.
So, yeah, and if nothing else, I mean, if you are in a position of authority, you need to have your mind open to new ideas. I mean,
yes. That
otherwise you may go down in history as being really foolish, and that's what—that's really what happens. You, in your book, Science Was Wrong. Time after time, these people who were so high and mighty in their day, in history, because they were so wrong and caused so many deaths. And usually it's deaths. I mean, usually it's not just people getting sick. You actually can say how many deaths they caused by their blockage of certain, especially things that people would do like hand washing. History does not treat them very well because, of course, the truth will come out, in some cases anyway, eventually.
It certainly will. And Billy Mitchell's one of my heroes. He said he could sink ships from the sky. And the Secretary of the Navy said that was absurd. And he got he lost in court for insubordination and so forth.
Yeah.
One quick story. November 29th, 1941, Army-Navy football game, big picture in the program of the USS Arizona, this enormous battleship. Mm-hmm. And the statement in the text was that nobody has ever sunk a battleship from the sky. 8 days later was Pearl Harbor. The Japanese sunk the USS Arizona. 1,100 men died.
Yeah.
Because the Japanese knew you could do it, and we weren't even allowing for that possibility.
I know. And why would you think they couldn't? I mean, dropping bombs from airplanes onto a ship that if you get one hole in it will sink. You know, come on.
You mean you don't need to vaporize the ship? Oh.
No, just one hole. and nobody alive on board to patch it, you know.
Very good. Well, it is useful. We really should do a second volume because, I hate to admit it, there are loads of other cases in which smart people have said stupid things. And
You should.
You'll have to get Kathy on. She did.
Yeah, I would. I'd like to. And I'd like to get you back on for your other book, and maybe we can talk about some of the medical things in more detail because we had a great conversation, but there's a lot more in your book that is worth people knowing about. So I'll have that arranged, and I'll get in touch with Kathleen, too. We are at the end of our hour. We've had a great interview with Stanton Friedman, who is the author of Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. I think it's important for all scientists to read this book because I think that scientists as well as the public need to know that new ideas need to be considered and not just dismissed. Next week, we will be interviewing Dr. Bruce Goldberg on soul healing, and then the week after that, Andrea Garrison, The Crossing Over of Maddie Pearl, and then Joseph Bislavac, Surviving Cancer, The Use of Complementary and Alternative Methods in the Treatment of Breast Cancer. Well, thanks, Stanton. I really appreciate you joining us. It was a fun interview.
Yes, it was for me, too.
Yeah, and we'll get back together and talk about some of the other things in science that's
okay.
wrong, and maybe talk about your flying saucers and the science.
Okay.
Okay,
thanks.
Super. This is Dr. Susan Call with Temple of Health Radio Show. Join us next week.